Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, I'll be interviewing writer Lynn Harris about the return of her comic Breakup Girl, talking about how reproductive justice is a freedom of religion issue, and how one Virginia news station is misleading its viewers about the Planned Parenthood funding debate. Also, the S&M side of the anti-choice movement. A shout out to our friends at Salon's Broadsheet, who offer a daily dose of engaging feminist blogging. They've recently added vlogging to the rotation, and I was impressed with this video from Tracy Clark Flory about how strange it is that no one ever warns men about the problems that crop up when raping someone.
My post got 156 reader letters, but I especially like this one from Tina Schreier. We never see an article saying a man should keep his shirt on, avoid getting drunk, not put himself in a situation where his intentions might be understood as aggression. I'd argue that the conservatives who propagate the gray rape myth don't warn men to avoid it because they believe that women are the sole sexual gatekeepers and deserve punishment for abandoning their post.
The comments section can get real nasty over there, and they're always happy to have more positive feminist voices, so drop on over and add yours. So let's talk about religion. Yes, I talk about it sideways all the time on this show, because considering the subject matter, I have to. But I don't think I've ever really done a segment on just the intersection of the religious versus secular debate and reproductive justice. I'm going to rectify that right now because I think one of the most powerful arguments that we can make for ourselves is to point to the First Amendment of the Constitution and the principles of religious freedom. Also, there's some recent news items that give me an opportunity. The PBS podcast, To the Contrary, addressed a recent Pew Forum study showing that Americans feel very free to switch religious affiliations or even to have none at all.
A new Pew Research Center poll reveals more Americans are abandoning or changing their religious traditions but keeping the faith. About 45% of Americans have left the mainstream religious groups of their childhoods and now identify with another affiliation or none at all. The Roman Catholic Church experienced the largest net loss, while the number of Americans who call themselves unaffiliated doubled in the last 20 years.
I think what this research shows is that Americans feel very free in their religious beliefs, which is a good thing. The First Amendment is not just an idea written on paper, but a lived experience for Americans. We enjoy a great deal of freedom of religion and freedom of conscience, and to show that, we will gladly church shop or leave a church altogether if it's not suiting our needs. The discussion on To the Contrary is fascinating and well worth listening to. For our purposes, I think this comment from Patricia Souza is the most relevant. The lead up is from the host and then Souza.
And the biggest loss of all was the Catholic Church, which is the most doctrinal in many, many ways, including, for example, most recently in Arkansas, telling parishioners not to contribute to the Susan G. Komen Foundation,
right,
because some of its money was going to Planned Parenthood.
Right. Bonnie, as a Catholic in the family, I have to say something about this. I feel so struck. We have to say something. I'm gonna explode. Because I think the Catholic Church is a great example of why people are leaving. They turn so political. You know, the Catholic faith I grew up was about poverty. It was about injustice and social justice. And all of a sudden, it turned so conservative, the emphasis on abortion, the emphasis on homosexuality, and I think it's turned a lot of people off. It's not so much the structure or the going to Mass on Sunday, but really the politicized.
But it's not,
I would say also more political. The church getting more political.
This is where we really begin to see how the reproductive justice movement needs to be intertwined with a broader insistence on freedom of religion. People are allowed, thank goodness, to leave a church that isn't conforming to their values. But religious freedom is about more than that. It's about not letting churches dictate the law based on religious dogma. If people are leaving the Catholic Church because they don't like the teachings on, say, contraception, then how is it helping their religious freedom then to see those religious teachings become the law that affects everyone, regardless of personal beliefs? What we're really struggling with, by and large, when we push against the anti-choice movement is a religious movement that is intent on making their personal beliefs the law that everyone has to live by. It's true that there's a vanishingly small number of non-religious people out there who are opposed to abortion rights, but that's mostly because they're uncomfortable with female sexuality and are hazy on the actual science. But the belief that life begins at conception is mostly a bit of religious dogma. What you believe about the soul is a private matter, not up to government dictates. And that's central to this debate. If you believe that it's a person with a soul upon conception, then feel free not to get an abortion. But don't put that belief on women who don't share it. This is why people who do feel personally uncomfortable with abortion or contraception should nonetheless be pro-choice. Because your freedom to believe how you want to believe depends on my freedom to believe what I wish to believe. It's not freedom of religion if it's revoked because you don't believe what you're told to believe. Duh. This is why I was glad to see that the religious freedom campaign, The First Freedom, is using the same language about privacy rights that draws a direct line to the pro-choice movement. This is from their ad with Catherine Dent.
Religious liberty is one of my first freedoms.
Like my free speech.
And my free press.
And my right to assemble.
My faith.
My faith.
My faith.
My right to believe.
To believe.
To belong.
To practice.
As I choose.
Is protected.
Private.
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 Endangered.
Hi, I'm Catherine Dent, and there's something I don't want to tell you. It's about my religious beliefs, but I'm not going to say more than that. You see, it's not because I don't want you to know about me, but it's because I don't know anything about you. I can't see your history. I can't see your beliefs. And what matters deeply to me could be an intrusion on what matters most to you. This basic respect for each other's beliefs is what I love most about being an American.
The group doesn't have an ad about reproductive health, though they have a page linking the issue with the secular democracy issue. But they do have an ad addressing the related issue of end-of-life care, using the same language about privacy and choice that's critical here.
I'm Jack Klugman, and at 85, I'm a lot closer to the end of my life than I am at the beginning. But I've had a good life, because I've always been free to choose the way I live. And that's why it's important to be free to choose the way I die. So I have a question for my candidates this election. Who should decide my end-of-life care? Politicians and religious leaders, or my doctor and me? That's my question. What's yours?
I'd like to welcome Lynn Harris to the program. Lynn is an advice columnist and the author of a webcomic called Breakup Girl from way back in the old days of the internet. She's also a mystery novelist. She's here today to talk about the glorious return of the webcomic come advice column Breakup Girl. Welcome to RealityCast, Lynn.
Thank you.
So how can people get new installments of Breakup Girl?
Well, very soon we are going to start launching a whole new series of Breakup Girl adventures at breakupgirl.net. We've been on hiatus for a little while because of a massive corporate conspiracy, but we're coming back. So by Valentine's Day, you should be able to see new stuff and follow Breakup Girl's new adventures.
What was the massive corporate conspiracy that was shutting you down?
Well, it's old news now, but let's just say we had a very bad breakup with Oxygen Media right around the year 2000, and we've been digging out, trying to get our stuff back, let's put it that way, ever since.
What led you to the idea of dispensing dating advice in superhero comic book form?
Well, I should say that I'm actually the co-creator of the whole idea. My creative partner, with whom I managed to be platonic roommates for over 10 years, is the super genius illustrator and graphic designer and webmaster, Chris Kalb. And we had collaborated on a book before, and back in 1996, the previous millennium, I was working on a book that was simply a humorous guide to surviving a breakup, and he was going to design and illustrate it. And we put our heads together, and as a way of giving the book character, literally, we came up with the idea of a superhero character who helps people through breakups, you know, because we thought, we need one of those. You know, we have superheroes who can bend steel bars, but how about one who can mend broken hearts? So that's where originally Breakup Girl, old-fashionedly enough, was first appeared in print. And then the following year, 1997, yes, the internet existed in 1997. We launched the website. We launched as sort of an online headquarters for Breakup Girl, and spun out a lot of the advice from the book, and turned that into an advice column, and then started creating ongoing comic adventures and just creating a whole world for both men and women about not only breakups but also, you know, makeups and hookups and everything beyond.
Yours is really the first webcomic that I think I've ever read. I don't know if there was much competition for webcomics back then.
We were actually the first webcomic. We were the first comic to flash-based comic to launch simultaneously on television and on the web. Little known fact.
On television?
Yep. We had a brief series on Oxygen, actually, which was really fun.
Oh,
and
that's
those,
really
you can
cool.
see those. You can see the animation at breakupgirl.net.
Well, now webcomicking is like a big, though not lucrative, business. Do you read other webcomics?
You know, I really don't. I'm not sort of a. I gravitate more towards. I'm not sort of a comics geek, which I say with all great respect, because I'm not qualified. to be one. Chris is really the comics guy, but even he, we've been so focused on, I guess you could say we're so into Breakup Girl that we're not really seeing other people.
So what other projects have you been working on lately?
Well, this we've been doing ever since our breakup with Oxygen. We've been doing this, you know, sort of by the seat of our pants, as opposed to, getting paid. So we've been doing Breakup Girl Catch as Catch Can and finding ways to update it and keep the site and the character alive for the last several years. And so we've also, you know, just gone on to continued with our, you know, paying jobs at the same time. So Chris has been, Chris is actually the designer of the art director for Sci-Fi Magazine. And I have been a journalist, which I was before and during Breakup Girl as well. So, and also an author. So I've been writing for Salon.com and Glamour and the New York Times and churning out a few novels as well. So my most recent one, which you mentioned, is called Death by Chiclet.
One of the things about advice, you're one of the few advice columnists that I actually enjoy reading and thinks gives really good advice.
Oh, thank you.
I don't really know how you feel about other advice columnists, but I have to ask, why do you think most of them just suck so badly?
Well, I think, I'm not going to say, I don't know, I can't say why many suck. I will say that, to put a positive spin on it, as I like to do in the column too, and by the way, I don't write the column at breakupgirl.net anymore. What I do is write the dating advice column at MSN. Which is linked to Breakup Girl. They're partners. They're partner pages now, just to be clear. But I think what's important, and, you know, this is like advice to anyone who wants to start their own advice column, is what's important is not, we didn't go into, start the column because we thought we were smarter than everyone else and knew everything and knew what everyone should do all the time. We started it because we had a concept about relationships that we thought was important. So we have a consistent place that we're coming from, and that is that, you know, first of all, it's not men versus women or women versus men or, of course, you know, women versus women and the, you know, not to be heteronormative, or men versus men. We didn't set up an adversarial relationship. Between the sexes, never have, never will. It's just not the way the site works, and that already positions you, I think, in a more thoughtful place as far as an advice column goes. And second, there's a Breakup Girl is a character and a fictional character, I might add. You know, when I got married, people were like, what's going to happen to Breakup Girl? And I was like, well, she's fictional, so I think she's pretty cool. Plus, it's not that Breakup Girl can never get married, but I digress. But I think when also you have a consistent voice, as opposed to just hearing yourself talk, I think that's also what can make an advice column come alive and be consistent unto itself. I think ultimately, you know, it wasn't that we understand relationships better than other people. It's that also the place we're coming from is just try to be decent. You know, don't be tacky in your relationships. Just try to, you know, do your best. And I think that makes that also is sort of a philosophy that informs the column and makes it, you know, again, makes it consistent and positive and also not just glib. Does that help?
Yeah.
Does that shine any light?
That sounds great.
Yeah.
So now I have to ask you for some advice.
Okay.
It's not for
live advice. Getting you off the hook on the spot.
Well, one concern that I've been hearing a lot from young people wanting more sex education is how to talk about safe sex with potential partners.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for my audience on that subject?
That's a really tricky one. That's a really tricky one. I do understand that there isn't contraceptive use at least up among teenagers. I think it is. So that's good. But of course, you can't be doing like a PowerPoint presentation on those statistics, you know, in the moment. In the heat of the moment. I think the key is confidence, and if you don't actually have confidence, then pretending you do. you know, faking it till you make it, and just saying, you know, look, it's not about what you say, it's about knowing that, like, if this talk doesn't go well, you're going to be okay. Because I think a lot of people kind of blow off or skim over the safe sex talk because they think that if they have it, the person won't sleep with them, and if the person won't sleep with them, their love life is over. And I think teenagers really have to just reassure themselves that, you know, I would never tell a teenager, don't worry, you'll forget who this is by the time you're in 12th grade. I mean, I'd never give them sort of, you know, broad perspective advice like that because they don't hear, you know, that's just not useful for teenagers. But just something about knowing that really, really, it's going to be okay if this conversation is difficult. It's really going to be okay. You're going to be okay. It's going to be okay no matter how it turns out. I think that would just set them up for being more clear and feeling more comfortable about what they're saying when they say it.
If you'd like to read more of Lynn's stuff, please check out breakupgirl.net or her book Death by Chiclet. Thanks for coming on RealityCast, Lynn.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
While looking around for information on the Virginia Senate's vote to defund Planned Parenthood completely, depriving low-income women of cancer screening and setting up the state for an uptick in abortion, I found good evidence as to why the voters of Virginia are rolling over for such wingnuttery. Their local media seems all screwed up. WCAV-TV of Charlottesville, Virginia, had a terrible, misleading report on this bill. Let us investigate the myriad of ways they are deceiving their audiences.
Good evening. Well, Planned Parenthood says the fact that they do administer abortions at their clinics could be why they're being targeted by this state senator. But they say the money they receive from the state goes to help give women health services and never toward financially assisting with abortions. And they say they are being attacked.
I'm sure this isn't technically false, but it strikes me as misleading to bring abortion up at all. The news report is insinuating, hell, outright stating that this is about abortion. And it's not. And the representative from Planned Parenthood does not actually say this is about abortion, but about other women's health services, including contraception, which, may I remind you, prevents abortion.
For Becky Reed, his effort is not about the money.
This isn't about the actual amount. It's about the fact that this is a politically motivated attack on essential prevention health care services that Planned Parenthood provides in communities throughout the Commonwealth.
Excuse me, did she say prevention? I think she did. She did not say abortion. So why bring it up unless you want to downplay the fact that the senator who introduced this is attacking popular services like STD and unplanned pregnancy prevention? Once again, we have media outlets refusing to tell the whole story about the anti-choice movement, which is that they are not pro-life at all, but anti-women's rights and anti-sex. I decided to do what the local news reporters apparently didn't have the time to do, which is examine Cuccinelli's record to see if he's just anti-abortion, or if he's got a larger social conservative agenda based around dismantling women's health care and pushing for mandatory rigid gender roles. Surprise, surprise. Cuccinelli introduced a bill to remove the requirement for girls to get the HPV vaccine. What does increasing cervical cancer rates have to do with being pro-life? Nothing, but it's great for punishing women for sex. He also tried to restrict the right of Virginians to get divorces, which has nothing to do with saving babies. He's also against gay marriage, though gay sex is an excellent way to avoid abortion. On his issues pages, he lists the two whole personal freedoms he believes people have. Two! It's so many! What are they? The right to carry a gun and the right of a pharmacist or doctor to refuse to offer treatment, i.e. the right to deprive a woman of her rights because you don't approve of her sex life. It took 10 minutes of Googling to show that Cuccinelli is opposed to women's rights and health care in general, and it's not limited to abortion rights, but WCAV-TV didn't take that time. They must have been too busy interviewing this dude at a crisis pregnancy center.
Another women's health service provider in the Commonwealth is the pro-life group called the Pregnancy Centers of Central Virginia. That group does not receive state funding at all.
We receive no state funding or federal funding at all for the pregnancy centers. The pregnancy centers are all done by our donor base. They're totally done by our people who just are supporters of what we do.
Boo-hoo! They don't get state funding and they're anti-abortion. Why, God, why? Well, I'll tell you why, and once again it took 3 seconds of Googling to find out. It's because the pregnancy centers of Central Virginia are not health services. In order to be a health service that lives up to the name, they should provide health services, and they don't. They give you a pregnancy test that you could buy at the grocery store and a lecture on how bad abortion is. Just to make absolutely sure, I called up the center and asked if they provided the most basic women's health care service, the pap smear. The volunteer hedged a bit and admitted they don't actually provide services in their center. But she said they had the names of some doctors. Pretty loose definition of a health care center. Under that definition, the phone book is a medical center. The state doesn't give them money because they don't provide services. It took me about a minute and a half of Googling and phoning the center to figure that out. So why isn't this in the ostensible news report? And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. Pro-Life News interviewed Kathy Coburn from the aptly named Bound for Life in Atlanta. From the name of her organization to her rhetoric, she's refreshingly straightforward with her belief that without the actual binding of women and forcing childbirth on us, there won't be any babies at all.
I think it's been an incredible day. One, it's amazing that the church would gather together today just to rally around the issue of life and asking God to come and bring life in our city, in our state. And so it was really an honor to be here. I really believe that it's the beginning of something new that God's doing in our state and our city as we're being unified and really asking Him to come and bring life, especially through this human life amendment. It's definitely an amazing, amazing opportunity that He's giving us.
Seriously, to hear her and other anti-choicers talk, you would literally think that giving women the right to birth control and abortion has meant an end to all childbirth, that maternity wards are going empty, schools are closing down, and obstetricians are out of work. In reality, there are about 4 million babies born a year in the U.S., according to the Census Bureau. 4 million is a big number to ignore, and yet here you have rhetoric that would make the stockholders of Toys R Us panic. Of course, this isn't about the absolute numbers. Coburn tips her hand later to what specific kind of baby the anti-choice movement wants to see more of.
Well, again, like you said, I'm with Bound for Life. Bound for Life is an organization that actually mobilizes the church to pray for the ending of abortion. We're also praying for an increase in adoptions, for righteousness in our government, and for spiritual awakening throughout our city and throughout our nation.
It's the lack of adoptable babies that's the issue here. Well, I'll admit that significantly fewer women are put through the trauma of giving up or being forced to give up a baby because it was born out of wedlock. And I agree with Bound for Life that as long as you aren't binding women for life, or at least binding them to the delivery table inside a maternity home, that's probably going to be the case. I just disagree that women should be bound to make babies for others to adopt.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Check. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.